Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 21st of Cheshvan. And today we get to meet a new Meshiv, the Chacham Tzvi, who's well known for certain things, including his discussion of a second day Yom Tov for those from outside of Israel who spend the holiday in Israel. But that's not our topic today. He's going to be talking about, my Bar Ilan tells me that Rav Tzvi Hirsch Ben Yaakov Ashkenazi, the Chacham Tzvi, was born in Moravia, which is in Czechoslovakia, in 1660. Then he went to Salonika to learn, so he became a Sephardi in a lot of his ways because he grew up Torah-wise in a Sephardi country. And then he came back to Ashkenazi countries, but he took the name of a Chacham, and then he served as a rabbi in Germany, in Amsterdam, in London, in Poland. And the Bar Ilan says that his response to reflect his wanderings and many stormy affairs, including his staunch opposition to Shabtai Tzvi, and he passed away in Lemberg, Poland in 1718. That comment on the storminess, some of it will come out in our tshuva as well, in our responsum as well, but it's also interesting because his son was Rav Yaakov Enden, who's also known for several controversies in which he was involved. So it's a family of undeniably brilliant people who know tremendous amounts of Torah, and also find themselves in conflict with others in their times. Just an interesting comment on the family. But this is from Shut Chacham Tzvi 39, Lamed Tet, from the 21st of Cheshvan of Tuf Nun He, of 1694. So he's writing to a mechutin of his, a relative of his, and he says he originally couldn't answer at length. He was busy, so he just told him that he thought it was mutter, the meat that they're going to be talking about, and now he's going to answer him at a little bit greater length. So here's the question. After an animal was shechted, so you have an animal, it was shechted in the home of a non-Jew, but it was shechted with a kosher ritual slaughter, with a kosher shkita, and so the man who owned the animal, let's remember that in times gone by, butchers didn't own animals. Butchers provided a service and you paid them for the service. You brought them an animal that you owned and then they shechted it, and the hope was that it would be kosher, and they did it right. They did it wrong. They messed up. I think they had to pay damages, but they weren't their animals. So the man has a shochet come, and he comes to the home of a non-Jew, which is, I guess, where he was staying, or where he wanted the animal to be for a meal they were going to have, but the animal gets shechted, and he says, Reshamti al, oh, I'm sorry, or they might have been partners, he and the non-Jew, and he was supposed to get half, and then I was supposed to get half, and then I just said, fine, you want to have a shkit to do it, a shochet to it, that's fine. So he puts a mark on one side of the animal so that he'd know that, oh, I'm sorry, no, he owns both halves. So he would know which is the kosher, this is the kosher animal that was shechted the proper way. And then without telling him, the non-Jew cut the animal into two. And now he comes into a room and there's a lot of pieces of animals, or not so many, but there are some pieces of animals, and he doesn't have a proof that that other half is part of this animal. So he's in danger of losing half his animal as a kosher animal. So, you know, if it was a sheep, let's say. So in this room, wherever the, you know, if it was a non-Jewish slaughterhouse, basically, and he had his Jewish shochet come, his Jewish ritual slaughter come to the non-Jewish house and shecht the animal for him, and he puts a mark on the animal. So that mark was going to be good enough for the whole animal, but then the non-Jew, for whatever reason, and there's no indication that the non-Jew is doing this for any nefarious reasons, but for whatever reason, the non-Jew cuts the animal in half. So when the guy comes back, he sees the two halves. They're right next to each other. I'm sorry, it's Mishor Echad. It's not a sheep, it's an ox. He sees there, or a cow, but a male cow, a bull. He sees there very similar, the two halves, as if they've been cut apart. And if he puts them together, puts them near to each other, they see, right? He says, and I put them next to each other, and the two, and the split, the cut, matched perfectly. So the question is, can he rely on that kind of evidence to assume that that is, in fact, the second half of the animal that was shechted, such that he can keep both halves as his kosher short? Because the head is gone, right? The neck is gone, so we can't do it by that way. But that's the question. So he, the man who was writing to the Chacham Tzvi, who asked the Chacham Tzvi originally, thought maybe you have to be Machmir, because there's a Taz in the name of the Isser V'het there, who says that nowadays we are no longer Biki'im to compare things, right? So the question will be what that means, but what the Isser V'het certainly means, if there was a tradition at certain times that if something looks similar enough, you can assume they came from the same animal, the Isser V'het says, we don't trust ourselves anymore. We don't think we are so adept and so skilled at seeing things that look like each other, to be matir on the basis of that, unless it's really, really different than everything else around it, right? If you had, you know, the fats of various animals and one and two pieces of fat look very similar, and everything else looks completely different, so maybe there. But other than that, the Isser V'Hetter wasn't allowed. So here too, the man asked the question, thought maybe that Isser V'Hetter's comment applies here as well, and the fact that they look very much like they match up, the two cuts, the two halves of the animal, the two sides of the beef look like they match up, maybe that's not good enough because we no longer trust ourselves to make those kinds of comparisons. So the Chacham says, no, he doesn't think any of that applies here, and that even the Isser V'Hetter would have agreed here, because that's not what he was talking about. He was talking about Shedimu HaShuman. So if you're comparing fats, if you have fat in the korkovan, like in the throat or some other part of the, or the stomach, one of the parts of the animal, and you want to put it in to compare it to the fat in the place where the two pieces of the animal come together, so that is that comparison of fats, unless they're completely different from each other, that wouldn't be so acceptable. Unless it was completely different, as we said before. But because there you can say it's a matter of expertise and being able to tell, and they can be, you know, the differences can be somewhat delicate or not so clear. So there we see that in the time of the Amoraim, there were people who would do it, and then we could say we no longer allow ourselves, I mean, in the time of the Amoraim, that they say we don't do it anymore because we don't trust ourselves anymore. But here, it's not a hard thing. It's like you feel it a little bit, or you just look at the width of it and the way that it contours itself. So therefore, he says there's no real issue of bikyut, of having to be expert in anything. And therefore, he doesn't think it should be a problem, because after all, there are other things. Like if you couldn't trust that to see the animals that were cut apart, the cut looks to match each other, then how do we trust ourselves to check the knife before we do shkita, right? You have to check the knife to be completely smooth. That's certainly a harder check than seeing that the two cuts of the animal are from the same animal. And he says, so that's what he thinks, really. So then you might say, and you couldn't say that it, maybe it's exertion, maybe yecholim la'amod bo, maybe you'd say, well, the reason that we allow it is because it's something that people couldn't put up with, or couldn't cope with. Right? Sometimes we do that with gzeira. We say if there's a gzeira that's too hard for the people in general to cope with, we don't make those kinds of gzeira. But here he says it's not a question of that, because if it's a thing where you just feel it a little bit, or you can see it, and you see that they look the same, or they're different, and everybody knows it, and everybody sees it, so then there's no question of bikyut, of expertise, there's no problem here. And therefore he thinks that you don't need to bring all of the sheep that were slaughtered that day, or all of the bulls that were slaughtered that day, you don't need any of that stuff, because we don't worry that maybe it turns out that there's a sheep that was cut in half, that's exactly the two ways, those kinds of distant concerns, we don't do it. The Truma Sadeshin had said the same thing, and everybody else passed in that way, and therefore he thinks there's no doubt about it. But the reason why you might have thought there was a doubt about it is that the Bach said that we shouldn't be mati this, we don't allow this, achim matimot, until they are matching, and also look exactly the same. So once you get to the look exactly the same, isn't that the area that we said that the Isser V'Hetter says we don't trust ourselves to do anymore, to trust that they look exactly the same? So he says, the Chazon Ish, the Chacham Tzvi says, no, I think it's the opposite. From there, it's a proof the other way, because even there we're saying, even if you can only match them by the way they look, so then you have this issue, it sounds like, but in general, he doesn't think it's a problem. And then there's a Ran that people read runway, but actually he says the Ran was understanding the Rambam to mean that when it comes to fish, that you might be allowed to do it even if you can tell not that they're from the same fish, but they're just from the same type of fish. I mean, let's say I have a fish that I don't know exactly what it is, and it looks enough like another fish that I say, oh, they are the same type, and therefore I'm going to say this fish is kosher, even though I can't see the signs of kosherness. So let's say, I don't know, carp. Let's say I had an actual carp that I knew was a carp, and then I had a piece of a fish, and I wasn't sure what it was, and I said it was close enough to that, it looked close enough to that, that would be allowed. So that's the Rambam being Mekel much more. He's allowing us, in the Chacham Tzvi's reading of the Ran, to trust ourselves even in that. But when they are cut from the same animal and you can tell that the cuts are the same, you think nobody disagreed about that, and even the Bach was Machmir, that's only when we say that the cut looks very different. But if the cut looks very similar, we think it's the same cut, it's the same piece of animal, so he thinks that's okay. So there are other examples of this in Halacha as well. So for example, there's a question that comes up in Nida questions, where we don't trust ourselves about certain things about Nida. So with the Nida, there's a woman who bleeds because of the natural monthly cycle that women that lead to menstruation and bleeding. And then there it can happen that a woman also has some kind of a scratch or a cut in that place. So theoretically, in Chazal's time, they thought that those bloods might look different. And therefore, if you were enough of a bucky, you could look at the blood and decide that it was this or this. But we no longer think that we're bucky in that we trust ourselves in that. But even so, in all the cases the Gemara says that we're allowed to assume that it's because she has some kind of a scratch or wound in that place that's leading to the blood, we still allow ourselves to that. In other words, the Chacham Tzvi is saying that when we say we no longer trust ourselves to be considered bikiim, to be considered expert, what we mean by that is we're not expert in the sense of those things that require expertise. But any of the things that the Gemara said you're just too allowed to assume, we're still allowed to assume as well, and this would be a similar case to that. So he says there's a Maharit that brought in a whole bunch of other issues into this question. He doesn't understand why, but those other issues, to me, are interesting issues for us to think about and learn about to a certain extent. So there are cases where we have to worry that maybe the non-Jew switched our kosher items with non-kosher items. And so one case would be where you have to, where you think that you're worried the non-Jew might want us to violate halacha. But even in cases where we have no such concern, there are cases where we have to worry anyway. So for example, if you hired a non-Jew to bring cheese on a ship, right? So we do worry, and the cheese wasn't marked in any way that would be hard for the non-Jew to get at. So what we worry about is that maybe the non-Jew sold the kosher cheese when he was someplace. He had the opportunity to sell the cheese, and this cheese was more convenient for the non-Jew to get to. And he had other cheese, you know, in the bottom, you know, back of the ship, and it was just a pain to go get it. So he said, all right, I'll sell this Jewish cheese, and I'll put in my cheese for that cheese. And let's assume that fundamentally they're of the same quality cheese. Right? So in other words, we're not ascribing to the non-Jew anything wrong. It's not that he's wrong in any way. I mean, he's wrong because he's taking stuff that doesn't belong to him. But he doesn't think he's cheating anybody in any way whatsoever, because he's replacing the cheese that he's taking now with cheese that's the exact same value, let's assume. Or in his mind, or his understanding of it, is the exact same value. So those are cases where we have to worry. What do we have to worry? We're not worrying that he's doing it to be mean to us or problematic. We're just worrying that it was more convenient for him, and he doesn't realize the issues for us. So there we say he's not going to go out of his way to hurt us. But also in those cases, we'll say if we make a barrier to him or make some problem for him, like we seal it up in some way or double seal it, he's not going to go to that trouble. Because the whole point is to save himself trouble. He's not going to go to that trouble to try to go through the double seal and then recreate the double seal for us. So that's where you get that whole idea. It's in cases where we have this worry about non-Jews switching with us, switching our materials for non-kosher materials. But it's only in those kinds of cases. In all those cases where we have to worry that maybe he needed it for something or that I sent it with him in some way, so there we have to worry. But where, says the Chacham Tzvi, Aval Heicha De'ika Kegon, whether there's another option, so let's say he's going to a place where there's not enough bread, there we'd have to worry. Maybe he'll get hungry and he'll say, all right, but by the time I get back to, you know, wherever the port is, like back to Haifa with my shipment, I'll have a time to buy new bread. So there we might have to worry about it, right? Because we're worried that he'll eat what he has now and then he'll replace it. Or the same thing with meat, where meat isn't all around. So, you know, he's got some meat on the ship that he's shipping for the Jews, and he knows he's going to get meat at another stop, two stops down before he gets back, and he figures, oh, I'll just replace it. And when he replaces it, he thinks meat is meat. So in those situations, we have to worry that he's going to replace it, and that he's going to replace it, and they're going to leave us with non-kosher meat, and therefore we can't trust him, and therefore we can't believe him if we say, is this the meat that he, because we think that he might have, he doesn't want to admit it, because he'll be embarrassed to admit it. So those are the cases we have to worry. And that's true even if it looks to us like the exact same meat. That's where we say we don't trust ourselves to know the meat. And that's why in those cases we want to have a double seal to make sure that we know that it's ours. And then he says, an interesting thing. He says, so he's just shown that the worry isn't they'll do it on purpose, right? If it was to do it on purpose, we might have to worry that if they're so bent, if they're so committed to causing us problems, that maybe they would... maybe they would cause us those problems on purpose, and then maybe even if it's double sealed, they would go through the effort of causing us those problems. So apparently we're not assuming that they don't cause us those problems, and they're not intending, it's just for their convenience that they would do it. Now what's odd about that, or interesting about that, or whatever adjective you want to use, is that the Gemara elsewhere does assume that non-Jews might murder people, right? We have to worry about non-Jews committing murder, and that's why the Gemara, at least in the Gemara's time, thought we shouldn't let ourselves be alone in a situation with non-Jews, because we have to worry that non-Jews would commit murder. So his answer, I can think of an answer of my own, I'll tell you in a second, but his answer is, that's only where he's got some beef with the Jew. They're enemies together, they're enemies to each other, and that's where we have to worry about murder. In other words, the Chachamim seems to be saying then, for all that the Gemara says, he doesn't say this explicitly, but he seems to be saying, that for all the Gemara says that a Jew shouldn't be left alone with a non-Jew, that's only with a non-Jew where there's some kind of bad blood. But if there's a Jew and a non-Jew and we have no reason to think there's a problem, the Chachamim almost seems to imply that they wouldn't have to worry about it. I might have also said, that murder is something where the level of caution that we're required to have is much higher, and therefore, because we don't want to get killed, so that maybe the Gemara doesn't generally assume that non-Jews want to cause this problem by switching our meat. They only do it for convenience, but it could be that they also don't generally assume that non-Jews commit murder. They just think the standard of proof and the standard of evidence is so much higher, it leads to us not allowing ourselves to be alone with non-Jews. Maybe that's another way to say it. In any case, but when it comes to our meat situation or our cheese situation, then we don't have to worry that they're going to have any problem with us. They're going to just decide they want to cause us to violate our religion. I'm sorry, and he says, so if you're worried that non-Jew is going to want to cause problems to a Jew and hates the Jew so much that he'll kill him, why don't you worry that he'll switch the meat? That'll be a lower level of revenge, but it'll be some kind of revenge, some kind of an annoyance to the Jew. So he says, no, he doesn't think that's enough. It doesn't satisfy the non-Jew in any real way, right? It doesn't matter to him. It's not like the Jew's religiosity matters to him enough that he cares enough to do these kinds of things. So, therefore, in our situation, coming back to our situation with the animal, there's no reason that we have to worry that maybe he made sure to sell the half of the animal that didn't have the mark on it to make some money off it, and he's going to replace it, because there's no reason to think that he would do that, because he had already sold it to the Jew, and because there's just no reason for it. That's what he thinks. I'm sorry, especially since kosher meat was even then more expensive. So this non-Jew would be a mistake for him. He'd be losing money by taking kosher meat and selling it as non-kosher meat or less, you know, less well-fed meat. So therefore, he doesn't have to worry about it, because we see that they don't want to do that and they don't do that, and therefore we don't have to worry about it. And maybe you'll say, what if he needed some meat, like in the case of the guy on the ship? So you say, to imagine they'll need a whole side of beef is hard to imagine, especially when he's going to be losing so much of it. But then he says, but don't think that it's because this is a butcher house, and we have a general rule that people who have a trade, they don't want to risk people getting bad reputation in their trade. Uman lo mirah nafshe. So he says, that's not really relevant here, because there's no real way to tell. When we say Uma Lomara Nafshe, he says, for example, like a non-Jewish chef is not going to mix in ingredients that are non-kosher and whatever if we ask him not to, because he'll assume that people will be able to tell. They'll taste it, right? So since they'll taste it, he's going to lose business for it. But when it comes to a butcher, right? So he's selling meat. It's not like if he brings in a different half of the meat, and it's still from a bull, but it's not from a kosher shechted bull. It's hard to imagine that people are going to be able to tell the difference of that. And that's what the Chacham Tzvi says, and therefore the non-Jew won't care about that. That's not a reason. He thinks he's got good reason, but that's not a good reason. And then at the close of the response to me, he says, I've now seen a sefer nitpas mechadash, newly published, nikra pri chadash, which is called the Pichadash, which is funny because he's living in 1690, so yeah, it was new back then. But when I was growing up, it was like a famous, important Acharon. So the Pichadash had a question about Iran. He had a contradiction in the Rans, where the Pichadash thought that an Uman yesh lodun lahalacha v'lo lemaisa shesom kin alav, that you can rely on an expert and a craftsman in various things, and it was he didn't understand why the Ran thought here that you couldn't and there that you could. And the Chacham Tzvi says, because there's different kind of cases. So let's say, for example, let's say a non-Jewish tailor, right? So if he gives him a bad garment, if he does a bad job, he he won't worry as much about doing a bad job for the Jew, because even if he loses the Jew's business, he'll still have plenty of non-Jewish business, and he's not losing any money of his own because the material all came from the Jew as well. But with other things that he might make, so let's say tchelet, and there was yain ribonim, like pomegranate wine, it seems. So there, he's making it, and if the Jews find out that he did the wrong way for their needs, since they need it for a mitzvah purposes, they won't take it at all. Whereas in the tailoring thing, they just want clothing, but they don't want the clothing to have shatnez in it. But they won't necessarily look so carefully, because what they care about is clothing. Whereas with the tchelet, it's for tzitzis, right? Or with the pomegranate wine, it's for mitzvah they're going to do with it. So in all those cases, they'll be much more careful about it, and that would be why, in those cases, we would say an uman, the craftsman, is more careful about it. But then he closes by saying, and then I also saw in this same sefer, this Pri Chadash, that he says you can leave cooked items in a non-Jew's oven. So I think it used to be the practice was in many places in Europe that, let's say you wanted to have cholent over Shabbos, so you'd leave it in the town oven, but the oven might be a Jew's or a non-Jew's because it was going to be open and running on Shabbos. So he allowed leaving it in the non-Jew's oven, the Tzorach Shabbos, for the needs of Shabbos, for a day and a night, as long as it just had one lock. Right? You didn't need a double seal, you had one lock. And he thought that was similar to a Oman, to a craftsman, a tradesman, who would not want to lose that business. Meaning, so if the non-Jew, takes a fee for the privilege of leaving our foods in his oven, he makes money off of it. So since he makes money off of it, we would say he's not going to do anything to ruin that business. So that's what the Pri Chadash seems to have said. And he said, as long as I close it up in some way, so let's say I had a closed pot, I closed the pot and I locked it in some way, that would be good enough. That's what he said. He also said, the Pri Chadash also said, he thinks it's more like a mafkid than like a sholeach. So sholeach means, let's say I send it with a non-Jew, like on the ship. I entrust it with a non-Jew, and he's going to take it somewhere for me. So there, we require a double seal. Pri Chadash said, when I'm going to leave it in his oven, it's more like I'm being mafkid, entrusting it with him in the same place. And therefore, when I come back, I'm going to see whether my seal's been broken or not. So for all of those reasons, Pri Chadash thought it was okay to leave it in that way. And the Chacham Tzvi says, everything that he wrote about this is a mistake. It's not true, because it's not at all similar to a tradesman or a merchant, a traveling merchant, who's going to ship things for us. And he says, and one lock is clearly not good enough, even though I see it, because one lock is enough to change, is easy enough to change or to reproduce, and therefore you can't trust in that. And the pot itself, you can't have a real semen about. So all he has to do is break through that lock and then replace the pots and then close the lock again. So he says all of that, he thinks, is not good enough and is not easy. You need more of a way to know that it was yours and that he hadn't had a chance to tamper with it before you were allowed to do it. And you can't say, well, I can recognize the fatty roast that I put in, because part of what's going to happen overnight is that it's going to boil off a little bit. So it's definitely going to change one way or the other. So you could say it's not going to change a lot, but it's going to change enough. The Chacham Tzvi thinks it's a problem. You couldn't do it in that way. And therefore, you have to do it with a chotam b'toch chotam. You have to do it with a double seal in order to do it. So it's not that you can't do it. You have to have a double seal. And then one more thing that Pri Chadash says. So that's the Pri Chadash allowed something that the Chacham Tzvi was sure you weren't allowed to allow, and that it wasn't allowed. And then he says, and he also prohibited something. He prohibited likroa haniyar hachatum b'shabbat. The Pri Chadash thought that you couldn't tear paper that's sealed like an envelope, basically. We would call it today an envelope in the mail. You couldn't tear it up. Afilo yedi'akum, even the non-Jew doing it. And the Chacham Tzvi said, that's completely not true. And he says that, and Hashem should forgive him, the Pri Chadash, that he said what was prohibited is allowed, what was allowed is prohibited, as I've shown in other places. And then he says, and I said all this to him when he was here with us. He came for a visit. So in other words, the Chacham Tzvi knows the Pri Chadash, or met the Pri Chadash, had talked with him in Torah, and he said all these things to him. And he writes, v'shatakli. And he was just quiet. So I don't know if he was quiet because he agreed, because he was upset, because he didn't think it was worth getting into an argument with the Chacham Tzvi. But in any case, he thinks that in our situation with this animal that was cut into two, he thinks both halves could be permissible, because you can tell, and Hashem should protect him from error. So that's the Chacham Tzvi on the question of the animal that's been cut into two and kashrus and trusting non-Jews and things like that, and some of the other issues that come up along with it, along with showing some of his personality by showing us how he reacted to the Pri Chadash, when the Pri Chadash came to town, brought his book, or he had his book, and the Pri Chadash came to visit, and what kind of a host in that issue, in that instance, the Chacham Tzvi was. Have a great day. Responsible day for the 21st of Cheshvan, Chacham Tzvi, on when we know how we can trust ourselves to know which animals are still the same animals as the ones that we once upon a time knew to be kosher. Have a great day.